Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
How was your Tuesday night? What did you do? Did you hit the gym? Did you spend some time with the kids? It's good. It's nice. You should spend time with the fam. Or maybe it was not so nice. Maybe it was tough. Maybe you had to put in some extra hours in the office. Maybe you got stuck in traffic. Whatever you were dealing with, I can pretty much guarantee it was better than Dylan Bundy's Tuesday night. And yes, if I am talking Orioles baseball, something very bad happened. Because, well, considering that the O's were 8-26 going into last night, bad things happen pretty much every single night to Baltimore. But I don't talk about them. So it has to be truly, truly terrible for it to ding my radar. And Dylan Bundy had a truly, truly terrible night. A legendarily bad night. My man had a serious case of the Mondays on a Tuesday. So let me back up first a little bit and let me introduce you to Dylan Bundy. Let me give you a little background on this guy. He was the team's opening day starter. He's got some good stuff. He had an ERA of under 1.5 in his first five starts. He was under 2 at the end of April. He allowed only one home run all season going into last night. And he's doing all these things on a really bad team. Bad team, good pitcher. Yes, he had a couple of tough outings against the Rays and the Angels. But those were nothing compared to what happened last night. Because nobody has ever had anything happen to them like this guy had happened to him last night. Now, let me take this very slowly because it was a historic night and I want to make sure that everybody drinks it all in and can truly appreciate what happened to this guy. He toes the mound at Camden Yards. First batter he faces is Royals left fielder John Jay. That at bat goes like this. Ball, called strike, infield hit. You know, not bad, not ideal. You never want to let the leadoff batter get on to start the game, but maybe you force a ground ball, you get a double play, you get right back on track. Not a bad thing. Jorge Soler was the next batter. He takes a ball. He fouls one off, and then he hits a home run to left center. 2-0 Royals. All right, fine. Shake it off. Long fly ball. That's all. That'll happen. Hit reset. Settle in. A 2-run deficit in the first inning. Not a big thing. Nothing hurt. Nothing hurt. Here comes Mike Moustakas. Focus on getting the batter. Limit the damage. Let guys, your guys, get to the bat rack themselves. Ball. Foul. 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 Ball. Ball. Home run to right. 3-0 Royals. Back-to-back home runs. Three batters, three runs scored, and here come the boos. Now we officially have a situation on our hands. This is not going well. Two bombs allowed. You still haven't got anybody out. This could get really, really ugly. But again, in a park like Camden Yards, trailing by three runs is not the end of the world. You can easily get that back. Here comes Salvador Perez. Just get him out. Stop the bleeding. I feel like I'm at my son's high school game and all the parents are screaming, just get the out, just get the out, just get the out. Ball, home run to center, 4-0, back to back to back bombs. Now at this point, you can just forget momentum and just try to get out of the inning. Better yet, don't try to get out of the inning, just try to keep the ball in the yard. Keep the ball in the yard, three home runs before a single out. Lucas Duda comes to the plate. Ball, 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 ball. Walked him on four straight pitches. Now, if I'm in the O's dugout, I'm actually popping champagne. Don't get me wrong. I don't love the fact that my starting pitcher walked the fifth guy he faced on four straight pitches, but at least he kept him in the yard. Maybe we get a double play. Maybe we salvage some dignity. Roll him up, boys. Roll it up. Roll it up. Here's Whit Merrifield for the Royals. He fouls one off. Actually, a strike and then a foul ball. Way to work ahead, kid. Way to work ahead, D. Then, ball, 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 and he walked. Two straight walks. So let me recap this glorious inning. Infield single, three straight bombs, two straight walks. I'm not sure what the plan was for that start, but it is really not going to plan. Here's Alex Gordon. two men on. He takes a ball. He fouls one off. And then you guessed it, three-run jack, 7-0 Royals. And if you think that sounded bad as I was, recapping it, the audio and the video makes it so much worse.
And a fastball is crushed deep to center field, and Jorge Soler has given the Royals a 2-0 lead.
Listen to the Royals fans that are in the house here at Camden. Nicely done. Look for the fastball. Don't miss it.
And that pitch is hammered. Look out, warehouse. Mike Moustakas hits it out onto Utah Street.
You know, just had the feeling before we even came to Camden Yards that the moose would get loose.
And now Salvador Perez hits a shot to deep center field. Back to back to back.
Shock the house at Camden. Unbelievable outburst in the first inning.
And now Alex to right field. And that is gone. And the Royals have four home runs in the top of the first inning and a 7-0 lead.
Listen, I don't know if they're miking the batters better than ever, or if the sound is just echoing because there were maybe a dozen people at the game. But damn, the crack of the bat seemed loud. Seven batters, four homers, two walks, and a single, and zero outs. And he did it all in 12 minutes flat. So credit for working quickly. Dylan Bundy was done, but not before making history. The game of baseball has been played for a very long time by a lot of people, and nobody's ever had an outing like Dylan Bundy. He became the first player in modern MLB history to give up four home runs without recording a single out. In other words, there have been a lot of pitchers who've had a lot of terrible innings and terrible outings, but nobody's ever had one as bad as Dylan Bundy had last night. He left the game with an ERA of infinity. Infinity for the game. That's not a joke. That's a mathematical fact. So what do you say to a guy like that when he gets back to the dugout? Yo, shake it off, kid. Shake it off. I mean, you can't say that. Do you try to go with something like, well, you didn't throw a lot of pitches, so that's a good thing? Or do you just try to take the honest approach of, hey, look at the bright side? Actually, don't, because there isn't one. And if you're Bundy, what do you say to the media after the game? Well, here's what he actually said. Quote, I was leaving pitches right down the middle, and they were hitting them over the fence. End quote. Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. You were throwing pitches right down the middle, and they were hitting them right over the fence. Actually, perfectly said. But he went on to say, I got us in a 7-0 early hole. I couldn't climb out of it. End quote. See, the problem is not that you got in the 7-0 hole. It's that you refused to stop digging when you got in that hole. You were trying to shovel your way out of that hole, and it simply wasn't working. And then I'm not sure what's worse, that he staked Kansas City to a 7-0 lead without getting one out, or that the O's pitchers gave up another three more runs before they ended up the top half down 10-0. I mean, never a good sign when multiple players on the other team are 2-for-2 in the first inning. That's a bad sign. It's a terrible sign. But then again, the O's are a terrible team. And Dylan Bundy had a terrible night. Look, every pitcher, even the best ever, gets touched up. But nobody, even the worst ever, has ever had that happen to them. Good luck living with that for the rest of your life. I'm not here to pile on a guy who had a bad night, but that guy had the worst night. Absolutely incredible. Four home runs, and he didn't record a single out. Not I gave up four runs before I got a single out. Four home runs before a single out was recorded.
Shock the house at Camden. Unbelievable.
If I'm starting with the O's in the middle of the NBA and NHL playoffs, you know something horrible happened. The U.S. Postal Service is an important tool for any business, including mine, and I'm sure yours as well, because it reaches every household every single day. And Stamps.com is the easiest way to access all the amazing services of the post office. Stamps.com never closes, which means you can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. You can print postage for any mail class right from your own computer. Plus, it's the exact amount of postage every time, so you never underpay or overpay ever again. And my favorite thing about Stamps.com, it saves me time and money, which you can then use to grow your business. I can mail any letter, any package using just my computer and printer, and then the mailman will come pick it up. I use Stamps.com because it is so easy and it saves me so much money. Literally the best thing ever. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer, which includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Simply go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in jungle. Stamps.com, enter jungle. Once again, Stamps.com, enter jungle. My guest is Chad Morris. Chad, great to have you on the program. How are you?
Jim, how you doing?
Good, Chad. How about you? How are things?
It's going well. Doing well right now. Obviously, in the month of May, where everybody's out on the road recruiting, and really, you're on the circuit of speaking to all the boosters across the state right now.
No doubt about it. Let me get you to go back a little bit. So when you first complete your first set of spring practices at Arkansas, Chad, when you took over in December, you go in there and you have to hit the ground running from the standpoint of getting to know everybody in that program. Then you hit the recruiting trail. Then you prepare for spring. Knowing all of that, and you just touched on what you're doing right now, how pleased are you with what you've seen this spring top to bottom?
Well, Jim, I'm incredibly excited about the future and about what's next for this program. Obviously, there's a lot of areas we have to address. We've got to address team speed but we've had a really good spring. The players really bought into the new culture and the new way of doing things. Obviously, a new offensive style is what these guys have been used to. So it's been well. It really has. It's been met with great reception with our players.
Yes, I'm going to talk to you about that, the culture and also the offense that you're going to run there and how different it is from what they had. But you had a really good thing, Chad, going at SMU, and you completely turned that program around, so your name started to come up for a lot of other vacancies. What was it about this opportunity at Arkansas that made you feel like this was the right spot?
Well, I think, Jim, when you look at any job change, it's always about timing and fit. And when you looked at what we did at SMU and taking over a program, and I really thought it was going to take us about 5 years to get it flipped, and we did it in essentially 2.5-3 years. And when the job started opening up, I just kept thinking, Arkansas is the one. And the reason is it is so much about the recruiting and the footprint that we're going to have to be successful at Arkansas. You've got to get a great mixture. Obviously, you got to win the state of Arkansas in recruiting. Memphis, Tulsa's got to be a huge emphasis, and more importantly, you really win and get a good mixture of the kids in the state of Texas out of there. You don't have to get all of them; you just get a couple and sprinkle, especially East Texas. And so, with my background in coaching high school ball in the state of Texas for 18 years, I had that. I was in Tulsa. I recruited the Tulsa area, recruited Arkansas, Memphis area when I was at Clemson. And so I just felt, Jim, that the timing, you got a passionate fan base to get this program back right, was what we have to what we definitely have that we could add to the program.
Chad Morris joining us, the Arkansas head football coach. Chad, you mentioned the style of offense. Now, obviously, your style of offense is very different from what was there before. So how do you go about approaching the challenge of shifting from a group that huddled and played at a much slower pace than the one that you're going to want to play at yourself?
Well, it's kind of like, when the water's really cold, do you dip your toe in it or do you jump straight in it? And we've taken the approach that we're just diving off straight in it. And it started in January when those players got back from the way we train with Tremaine Carroll, our strength coach, and our strength staff, and our demands, our expectations. And, they went from huddling, running about 61, 62 plays a game, to what we're going to be running. We want to be in the 85 to 90 plays a game. And so there's only one way to do it, and it was just to show them exactly what we want to have done and just don't let up. Just keep the pedal down.
Yeah, Chad, it's a conversation you've had in the past, of course, because you are a big numbers guy, especially as it relates to what we're talking about, the number of snaps that an offense takes during a game. Before you arrived at Clemson, for instance, they were snapping the ball 55 times per game, and then when you first started to talk to Dabo Swinney about that, you were pitching him on the idea of more snaps. Take me back to that conversation. What was that talk like?
Yeah, I'll never forget what we were talking, and I said, Coach, really, you're averaging 55 snaps a game last year. You score a touchdown or field goal one out of every 13 to 15 snaps. So tell me, Coach, what would 3 to 7 more points have done for you the previous year? And I believe that was 2010. And he said, well, it was really quick. And Dabo does, he looks at me and he goes, well, you wouldn't be sitting here if we had that. Hmm. And I said, well, exactly. So that's to my point. And so the emphasis of playing at a very fast pace and upping our tempo is so critical.
We're talking to Chad Morris. I mean, you sound like a sales rep. Now, if I could get you, if I could find a way for you to score 3 or 7 points more per game, would you be interested, Mr. Prospect? Well, yes, I would. Tell me about that. So you took over at SMU, and then you went after they went 1-11 the year before you arrived, and then in your third season, as you point out, you had them in a bowl game. So when you have a rapid turnaround like that, how much of that is about changing the talent, and how much is about changing the culture?
Well, I think it works hand in hand, Jim. I think that you have to address the culture issues and how you do things and the accountability and the work ethic and the energy that it provides that it's going to take to be consistent in your daily approach. We first got to SMU. We were just battling and just daily wins. You know, we knew we were getting better, but we couldn't see the end result on the scoreboard, but we knew we were feeling it inside our own building. And so it was just about creating daily wins. What can we do today, whether that's taking good notes in a meeting, whether that's, you know, staying off the ground and inside drill. And we had to celebrate those things, Jim. And so much of that and bringing in the caliber of players that fit what we do and how we do things. You know, we all know that great players make you great coaches, but you also have to have a culture that everybody has to abide by within the program, and that's equally as important.
Arkansas head football coach Chad Morris joining us. Now, Chad, one of the phrases that was used at SMU is E plus R equals O. What does that equation mean, and then what's it like to see your players buy into it and believe it and put it into work?
Well, yeah, you know, we worked with Brian Kite. Brian Kane works with us. And talking about a lot of those things, you know, E is the events in your life. There's a lot of things. You can't control the events that go on in your life, on your day-to-day life. That pop up, you can't control those things. So many times we as coaches, we as people or players spend all this time and energy focusing on the things that we can't control and not worrying about the things we can control. So we tell them all the time, look, you can't control the events in your life. You know, you were born into the last name you got. Doesn't matter all your circumstances that got you to this point, you can't control it. The outcome, you can't control the outcome of a situation. And this is where you get a lot of players will say, yeah, well, coach, I can. I said, well, if you could have, then we would have won the national championship the last 3 years because we worked as hard as anybody. And I said, so there's a lot of times you can't control the outcome and things. But what you can control 100% is how you respond. And that's how the response goes, or the R goes in the E plus R equals O. And if you want a better outcome, choose a better response. And we use that all the time, Jim. You know, we talk to our players about you get in a situation. Suppose you're in a party, something happens. That's an event. You got a response at that point. Do you leave? Do you stay? Do you help? What do you do? And that in turn leads to an outcome.
E plus R equals O. Chad Morris joining us. Before I let you go, before SMU, you were the offensive coordinator at Clemson, and you, of course, were involved in the recruitment of Deshaun Watson. When did you first meet Deshaun Watson, and what did you think of him when you first saw him?
Well, I had been at Clemson about 2 weeks, saw his tape, came across my desk. He was a freshman at the time, just finished his freshman year. Watched 3 clips. The first clip I watched, he the ball came out of his hand, man, it just jumped out. And I said, well, that kid's got a great release. Second clip I watched is the pocket broke down around him, and he escaped out. And I said, wow, that kid can run a little bit. And the third clip, he handed the ball off, Jim, and he carried his fake out 10 yards. And that clip alone said, man, that's a freshman. It's hard to get anybody. It's hard to get a senior in college to carry out a fake 10 yards. This is a freshman doing it. And so that came to huge interest. He and I started talking and building a relationship at that point. And we got him to come to camp his freshman year. He comes to football camp, spends 3 days with us. He spends 2 days because he leaves, and he brings Gainesville's basketball team, comes back to Clemson for the basketball camp 2 days later. And this was during our vacation, our summer vacation. And me and Jeff Scott sat on the front row in the gym waiting on Deshaun Watson to walk in basketball. And I'll never forget. I just keep thinking to myself, man, I'm giving up a couple of days of vacation for this kid. I sure hope it's going to be worth it. And I remind him of that quite a bit, by the way. So he's a great one.
He's a great one. You know, it's amazing, too. He likes to refer to you as a father figure, and I know how tight that bond is between the two of you. Even though, Chad, you only coached him for 1 year, how would you describe the relationship that the two of you have? And then what kind of a person is he?
Well, everybody sees what he does on the field. Obviously, you see some of the things he does off the field to help his community out. He's a far better person than he is a football player. I mean, he is truly like a son to us, to Paul and I. He's constantly in contact with me. He talks to Paula more than he does me. He talks to my two kids. I mean, they're all, he's like an older brother to my two kids. And I tell you what, I would sum Deshaun Watson up that, you know, he's the type of kid that, you know, your daughter brings home and says, you know, she wants to spend the rest of her life with a guy like him. You would embrace that every day. He's that special of a person.
Normally when something seems too good to be true, it is, but not in his case. Chad Moore is my guest. Hey, Chad, one last thought. You're really big on numbers, but you're also big on details. There's this story from back in the day, and please tell me whether or not this story is true, that when you were hiring assistants in high school, you always made sure there was a piece of paper on the ground. Is that true, and what's the story behind that?
Absolutely. You bet it's true. And I share this with our players about the small things. And Jim, I'll usually plant something a little bit larger than maybe like a 2-inch by 2-inch sticky note you kind of wad up. You put it on the floor about midway up the hallway on the right-hand side. I go and I always get everybody that I interview, and I walk them back. And when I walk them back, I always make them walk on my right side so that they have to walk past the piece of paper on the floor. And if they'll stop and pick the piece of paper up, put it in their pocket, and carry on like there's nothing, or drop in the trash can, we come back to my office, I'll immediately start talking about that piece of paper, and then we start talking about there's no job too big or too small that you won't do. And 90% of the time, probably 100%, I have to go back and look at all of it, I hire that person right off. Or they walk past it, they don't pick it up, I'll ask them there, I'll say, well, look, do you see a piece of paper in the hallway? They'll either say no or yes. And so it is. It is true. It's absolutely true. And it just shows you about the small things.
Details matter. Chad Morris, head coach at Arkansas. He was named head coach in December, and they open up their year against Eastern Illinois August 31st. Chad, so good to have you on the show. I appreciate the conversation. Nice to talk to you. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You bet, Jim. Look forward to getting back on with you and appreciate all you do.
Anyway, Kyle, stay strong, kid. Stay strong. In the meantime, let's talk some basketball. It's here. It's finally here. The matchup we've all been waiting on since June. That's when Chris Paul went to the Rockets, and that was when the Rockets went all in on beating Golden State. Everything since then has been the appetizer. James Harden's MVP season. The franchise record, 65 wins. Houston's absurd record when Harden, Paul, and Clint Capella play. All of that building up to this, the Western Conference Finals, the showdown with Golden State. Of course, the final step to that, the mozzarella stick on the appetizer platter, was finishing off Utah. And for most of last night, Houston made that look much tougher than they should have. Well, Houston and Utah made it look much tougher than they should have. Because say anything you want about Utah, the one thing you cannot say about the Jazz is that they're soft or they quit. They're down 2 point guards, and they still gave Houston everything they could handle. Utah was down 8 at halftime, and then Donovan Mitchell exploded for 22 in the third quarter. The guy's an absolute star. That gave the Jazz a 3-point lead going into the fourth, and for a moment, it looked like they might rip that thing. But then he went down with that knee injury with 7 minutes left, and that was the end for Utah. Except it wasn't. The Jazz kept fighting. They scored 7 straight. They cut Houston's lead to 1. And then it looked like they might rip it again. And then Chris Paul went to work. I mean, there was no more tired notion in all basketball than the one that Chris Paul was a playoff choker because he had not reached the conference finals. But if you went into last night thinking that that was the case, then CP3 took a sledgehammer to that idea. 13 straight in the fourth quarter. And I'm not sure who was better. Chris Paul on the floor or the icon, Kevin Harlan on the mic.
Screen Paul inside on Gobert. Walking the tightrope. 3, Chris Paul!
3, Chris Paul! That made it 196. He was even banking them off the glass as the shot clock expired.
It's O'Neal, shot clock at 2. Paul, the dance, fires, goal!
I don't care if you call glass or not. Heat check for CP3.
I don't care if you call glass or not either. That was a heat check. Chris Paul got it again.
Now you add a future Hall of Famer to the mix.
Paul, he got it again. Chris Paul has been an assassin.
Chris Paul has been an assassin. So a legendary performance from Chris Paul. And the only guy in the building who could keep up with him was Harlan. KH matching CP shot for shot. Meantime, Donovan Mitchell was trying to fight his way through the pain to get back on the court. Love this guy's attitude. Love his effort. But it would not have mattered. Not when Chris Paul is going for a playoff career high 41 points, 10 assists, 8 three-pointers, 7 rebounds, and not a single turnover. Another great playoff performance and another tired meme destroyed. Ask the beard, James Harden. How would you describe what you just saw?
That's big time right there. It's a big time performance. He got in his bag and, you know, he called everybody off. He said, you get out the way, I'm going to put him in the bag. He had that look in his
here,
eyes.
Here you go.
I mean, if he has a... I don't care what you say. But, you know, and if he has that look in his eyes, you know, every single night, he's a problem.
Well said. He got in his bag all right. Dude got in his bag all right. And yes, if he's doing that, he is going to be a problem. A big, big problem. Oh, and right about now would be a pretty good time to point out that it looks like Chris Paul got the better end of that Blake Griffin divorce. One guy is sitting at home, coachless, playoffless, and in Detroit. The other just carried his team into the Western Conference Finals. One game got his team to the Western Conference Finals, or one guy. The other guy got his coach fired. Got himself traded to the Pistons. Either way, Paul came out of this a hell of a lot better than Blake did. Who would you rather be? Who's got the better situation? Who got the better of that divorce? Who got to keep the house and the jet and the vacation home and the cars? Who got the better of that deal? Game, set, and match, CP3. James Neal is my guest. James, good to have you back. How are you?
Good, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. Great to have you back. Now, when you and I talked back in January, we talked about the special year this team was having, and now we're talking in May as you await for the winner for the Western Conference Finals. What have the last few months, and in particular, the postseason been like for you and for the team?
Yeah, I mean, right from day one, it's been, a lot of fun, I think. Obviously, being an expansion team and having to come together as a team very quickly and getting to know each other and, and then working together and getting our systems right from our coaching staff and everyone kind of getting a feel for each other and building chemistry and, you know, everything that goes along with, becoming a good team. So we, had to go through fast forward a little bit and do it quickly. And we did that, and everyone's been great and a lot of fun to work with.
I'm going to ask you about a few of those things in a minute, but the fact is it's your eighth straight year of playing in the postseason, and you've got a reputation of coming through in the playoffs, leading to the Big Game James nickname. So is it something that you can consciously dial up when the playoffs roll around, or is it something that just kind of happens?
Well, I think it's just that, I just love playing the playoffs. The biggest thing is that I want to win a Stanley Cup, and it's something you dream of as a kid, and I've had a taste of winning in the past here, but I just haven't been able to finish it off. So I think that's what drives you. And, when those big games come along, you want to be able to step up. And, when you're as a goal scorer, you want to be able to get those big-time goals that the times your team needs you. So it's been great so far in the playoffs, and I think every guy on our team has stepped up in a huge way.
Golden Knights left wing James Neal, my guest. The other thing that keeps coming up is when guys talk playoff hockey, it's not just that the intensity ramps up, but the feeling is the rink actually gets smaller. Is that how it feels to you? And then how do you deal with that extra intensity in postseason hockey?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just how the fans are reacting to everything. Every little play means so much more, and The physicality is obviously ramped up a ton. So, when guys are coming after you every chance you have the puck, and they're going to be physical on you, it definitely makes the rink feel a little smaller than it is. And but I think that's a good thing for us because our rink's been great all year. The fan support's been been awesome. The passion this city has brought to our team has been really cool to play in front of, and that's just an advantage for us.
I'm on the outside looking in, but I've never seen anything like that, the kind of fan intensity you guys have, which I'll get to in a minute. But the other thing that you and I spoke about earlier in the season, you broke your hand in last year's playoff run with Nashville, and then you spent all of September on the injured list. You weren't even expected to be ready to start this season, but you did. And even though the hand didn't feel completely right, you've said that it's taken pretty much all season for you to get that strength back. So how good does it feel to have it when you need it most on the big stage?
Yeah, that's that's been the nicest thing, I think. A lot of times and a lot of players go through it all year with injuries and stuff. And, for me, it's been a nice change that, I finally feel 100% going into playoffs. So that's usually not the case, especially after you battle for 82 games to try to make the playoffs. And, your body takes quite a toll. And so it's been nice to be able to be healthy in playoffs and, contribute as much as I can, but, I'm feeling really good.
Vegas Golden Knights left wing, James Neal, my guest. And then you've got a guy standing on his head between the pipes in Marc-Andre Fleury. He has been a monster in the postseason. So what do you think when you see him play the way he is right now?
Yeah, a guy I played with in Pittsburgh, so I knew what he was capable of. So couldn't be happier to have him picked in the draft to come on this team with us. But, a guy who's won 3 Stanley Cups, he's been there, he's done it, and he knows what it takes, but at the same time, being unprotected and leaving Pittsburgh, he has something to prove, and he wants to show people how good he is, and that he's a winner. So he's definitely been doing that, but he's such a great guy, and he's been so good for us. He's won us games night in and night out. And, we wouldn't be where we are today if we didn't have him.
James, it's one thing when you have a guy like that in the room, but it's another thing when almost every single guy like that is in the room. A team full of guys who are left unprotected by other teams, it's got to be a pretty emotional thing when you pour everything you have into a team and a city, and then they leave you unprotected, and then suddenly you're with another team. It seems to me it would be pretty easy for guys to get angry and not be in the right headspace for the season, but it seems like your entire room has rallied around that. How are you able to manage that and take advantage of that?
Yeah, it's. Each guy has a different situation, and of course, it's tough. No one wants to leave unprotected. Some guys, maybe this is a good thing for them. It gives them a chance, a different opportunity here. Leaving Nashville last year, and pouring everything into a city, and being one game away from a game 7 and playing for the Stanley Cup, it was tough. So, I think it gives you that extra motivation, but everyone on the same page and. Everyone wants to work for each other, and we all have the same goal. We all want to win, and we know that we have to do that together. So right from day one when you're introducing yourself to each other and right from the whole season on, I think, our consistency has been, pretty special thing. You know what each guy is going to bring to the table every single night, and that's what's made us such a great team.
All right, so speaking of Nashville, before you go, you were there 3 years. So right now you're waiting on an opponent for the Western Conference Finals. Is there any part of you that would like to get a shot at them and let them know what they're missing?
Yeah, I know it's tough. Last year being in Nashville, I'm playing against Pittsburgh, who traded me to Nashville. So, and then now I leave Nashville. I'm playing for the Golden Knights. We're having a great year, and now I'm waiting for one game to see if I'm going to play my old team. So it's pretty fresh in your mind. But I'm just going to enjoy a game 7. Tomorrow night, and whatever happens, hopefully it's for the best, and stay positive, and I look forward to if I have to play the old guys, and can't wait to do that, but it'll be a little bit weird, but we'll get over that pretty quick. I guess I have some experience playing the old team, so I did it last year, and if we do it this year, hopefully it'll come out on top.
That'd be something to see. Before I let you go, and I can't let you go without asking about the fans, they were getting fired up outside the arena before Game 5 of the San Jose series. When you clinched that series, there were people dancing on Fremont Street. When you first arrived in Vegas, could you ever have imagined that this team would be embraced by this city the way it has?
No. It's been pretty incredible. I think everyone was excited to come here to Las Vegas and be the first professional sports team and, take this city by storm, but I didn't think it would ever be like this. It's been, it's been amazing, and the way the fans have taken us in, and the support we have is pretty amazing. So we love it. We love playing in front of our fans here, walking around town and being out eating, doing different things, and you know, people coming up to you and talking to you and saying how thankful they are for our team and for what we've done to this city. It means a lot. So it's been a special year so far, and we just want to continue going with it.
And finally, can you imagine? I mean, the next eight are the toughest eight, but have you even allowed yourself to think what it might feel like to have a Stanley Cup parade in Vegas? I mean, what would that look and feel like?
Yeah, I mean, you can always dream and wonder, and you know, bringing the Stanley Cup down Las Vegas Boulevard, down the Strip, I think that would be the next level. But like you said, we got eight more wins to do. We got a lot of work. You know, we're going to be playing some great teams. So don't get too far ahead of yourself. We know what we got to do, and we'll continue to put in the hard work. And we can't wait to get going here in the next series.
Fair enough. Vegas advancing to the conference finals, and they will await the winner of Winnipeg and Nashville. Left wing, James Neal, my guest. James, great to have you back. Thanks so much for doing that, and good luck. So with Houston clinching their spot in the conference finals, that came first. It then came down to Golden State and them following suit and getting the same amount of rest, right? They knew what was at stake last night. And while Draymond Green went with a, quote, long-ass text to Kevin Durant after Game 3, there were no texts from Steve Kerr before Game 5. Steve Kerr said, quote, "I dial people on my rotary phone. Nobody seems to answer. Nobody answers a home line anymore." End quote. Man, that's the truth. Can I tell you, do any of you even have a home line still? Because whenever we go to book a podcast guest, we want quality audio. So we say to people, can we get you on a hard line? Can you do it from your home? And inevitably, almost everybody says, don't have one. Do not own a hard line or a home phone, except for Steve Kerr. The truth is, he didn't need to tell anybody. They knew what they had to do. Then they went out and they did it. 113-104. Steph, 28 points. Man's game, Steph. Kevin Durant, 24 points. Klay, 23 points. Draymond with a classic Draymond stat line. 19 points, 14 rebounds, 9 assists, 3 steals, 2 blocks. Typical Draymond Green playoff game. And last night, Steph played his most minutes since coming back from injury. And while he says there's still some rust that he's got to knock off, Kevin Durant says he sees something else. Quote, "I think Coach did a great job, though, of just giving him a little bit here and there, and tonight really just letting him go. You see, when you let that dog off the leash, what happens?" End quote. Now, to be fair, that does not mean that New Orleans made it easy on them. Every time it looked like Golden State was about to put that game away, New Orleans came right back. Golden State was up 50-40 in the second quarter. It looked like that game was over, or would be over, by halftime. Pelicans then drop an 11-0 run on them, and they take the lead. And this pretty much sums up the Pelicans' season. Right when you think it's over and they should quit, like when Boogie went down, they don't. They come back tougher, and they did it again in the fourth. They were down 23 with 8 minutes to go. They cut that to 7 with only 2 minutes left, and then Golden State closes out. Series over. Press conferences begin. Draymond holding court. Let's start with Draymond Green being asked about Rockets big man Clint Capella. Capella said back in January that Houston was better than Golden State.
What'd somebody say after? Mm. What'd he say?
What'd he say?
What'd he say? Yeah, you gotta play the game now. You know, that's all fine and dandy in January. But now you got, you know, they got us, we got them. Gotta go out there and play, and we'll see who better.
See, now that's funny. Unlike the Cat and Hefty, that's funny. Draymond said, "What'd he say?" And then Steph jumped in and imitated him with, "What'd he say?" That's
what's
funny.
What'd somebody say after? Mm. What'd he say?
What'd he say?
That's funny. That's good. So then Draymond gets going. Draymond then gets going. He was warming up. He got going on Houston's so-called obsession with the Warriors.
You know, they have made it known that their team is built to beat us. You know, kind of their like you said, their obsession or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it is what it is. But like I said before, you know, all that stuff is cool. You can build your team. Obviously, you want to build your team to be the defending champs because that's usually how you got to go to get a championship, the way you got to go. So, all understandable. That stuff has been said for about a year now. It's time to play. So, just is what it is.
I like it. There's a little bit of that big brother, little brother dynamic there. And he's making it very, very clear. The Rockets are good, but there's a difference between those two teams. The Warriors were built to be the Warriors. The Rockets were built to beat the Warriors. This Houston team is a response to Golden State, so of course they'd be obsessed with Golden State. Draymond was also asked by Chris Haynes if he wanted to face the Rockets.
Man, we won two championships in 3 years. We're not about to run off talking about how bad we want to play somebody. Like, we want to win another championship. And it don't matter who's in the way of that. If you're in the way of that, then you happen to be in the way. But, you know, we're not about to run around like, yeah, we want to play them in the conference finals. For what? Like, it don't matter to us who we play. However, we got them. All right, now let's get it. We get to it now. But it makes no sense for us to run around, we want them as bad as they want us. For what? Like, that honestly don't make much sense to me. Like, we got a goal. And whoever's in the way of that goal, you know, then we got to see you. You got to see us. All right, now they in the way. Perfect. But we ain't been running around talking about, man, I can't. Like, we want them bad. Like, nah, we want a championship bad, another one. That's the truth.
He's in full Draymond mode. He is in full Draymond mode. I love that. Look, I know what he's saying. And I'm not going to say that he's not telling you the truth. I believe him. I get that. I know what he's saying when he says, we want a championship. We don't care who's standing in the way. But you can't tell me that he's not fired up that the Rockets are the ones who are standing in the way. Just look at the way he handled those questions about the Rockets. This is not just some other team standing in their way. This is the team that he wants to be standing in their way. Why do I say that? Because Draymond is a juice and energy player. Bob Myers said it when he came on the program recently. Draymond needs the high stakes. Draymond needs that to be at his very best. And he is at his best right now. He's in full Draymond mode. The stakes just got raised. Now, I'm not saying that the Warriors would not have been fine playing the Jazz in the conference finals. I'm saying they wanted the Rockets, like everybody else on the planet wanted the Rockets and Warriors to match up. Because they want to make a point to the Rockets. The point is, you're good, but you're not us. You're good, but you're not on our level. The way for the Rockets to become the champs is to beat the champs. And the way for the champs to remind the Rockets that they are who they are is for the champs to beat the Rockets. And if the press conference, nearly a week before game one, are this good, I can't wait for that series. Let's get it on. Last thought, Golden State has owned the Rockets in the postseason in recent years. More specifically, Golden State has owned Chris Paul and owned James Harden in the postseason in recent years. Harden is 2-8 against Golden State since Steve Kerr arrived. Paul is 3-9 during that same period. Both these guys have been embarrassed by Golden State in the postseason. Neither one of them has been competitive against Golden State. They figured the only chance they would have is if they came together and they joined forces. And so far, so good. Best record in the NBA in the regular season. Top overall seed. Very little resistance so far in the postseason. But the fact is, none of it means anything unless they get through. Not unless getting to the conference finals is good enough for Chris Paul. And it shouldn't be. These guys were built to beat Golden State. They admit as much. They're obsessed with beating Golden State. They admit that too. Everything they've done has been with this in mind. Here we are. Here we freaking are.
Here we are.
Let's see what you got.
Here we are.
Let's get it on. Remember when the Cat used to treat Hefty like a rag doll? The world's number one player, throwing around the world's number two player anytime he wanted to. Back when the Cat could do no wrong, scooping up green jackets, claret jugs, and Perkins waitresses during a run of golf that we may never ever see again. Well, yesterday was media day at the Players' Championship, and Tiger and Phil, two dudes who used to be sworn enemies, who hated each other's guts, turned it into a full-fledged bro-out. And honestly, it was one of the lamest things I've ever seen. Nobody wants to see these two dudes hugging up on each other. We want to see them choking each other out before they age out. And it's one thing to see these guys buddy up for a practice round at the Masters, but entirely another to see them prepare to do it for two actual rounds of a tournament that some people like to call the fifth major. And especially when they'll be paired together along with Ricky Fowler on Thursday and Friday. Hefty started the whole thing off with his media session yesterday. He started by talking about the last time they played together at Sawgrass, when the Cat was still the Cat, in the middle of maybe the greatest run in golf history. Phil may as well have puckered up and laid a big fat wet one on Eldrick.
It was the most remarkable golf in the history of the game, and I think unrepeatable. I think it was that good. Going back to, I look at 2000 as being kind of the benchmark at the U.S. Open as being the greatest golf I've ever witnessed, and I believe ever has been played. And it sucked to have to play against them. It really did. You look at it and you say, you know, how am I going to beat this?
My man, just dripping with it. But then because he's lefty, he added a little bit of spice. Because he's lefty, he made it about gambling.
The pairing is on there and the excitement that's been going on around here, it gets me thinking, why don't we just bypass all the ancillary stuff of a tournament and just go head to head and just have a kind of a high stakes winner take all match. Now, I don't know if he wants a piece of me, but I just think that I think it'd be something that would be really fun for us to do. And I think there'd be a lot of interest in it if we just went straight to the final round.
No way. He turned this thing into a discussion about gambling, not Philip. Great idea, Philip. What do you say we run this by your new best bro, Eldrick?
Well, first of all, big picture.
Overall, you're only one up on him, though, head to head.
How many times have we both
32.
Won? 32. No, have we won on tour?
So, yeah, there's that.
Yeah. I'm definitely not against that. We'll play for whatever makes him uncomfortable.
And what would that be?
We'll find out.
I gotta tell you something. What would you give to have Tiger's audience? I mean, listen to these cackling fools. My man starts off with, first of all, and just brings the whole house down. Like the funniest thing anybody's ever said. First of all, and somebody in the room snorted because they thought that was so hilarious. And then he breaks out with big picture, and then the entire room loses it. From now on, I'm just going to walk around my house and say, first of all, big picture, and then wait for the laughs. Because listening to these fools in that room, that's about the funniest joke in the history of the world.
Well, first of all, big picture.
Hey-o! I like also, first of all, whatever makes Phil uncomfortable. Hey, Eldrick, you sure about that? Because say what you want about that dude in the baggy shirt. The one thing that does not make him uncomfortable is wagering. One thing that Hefty has never been afraid of is digging into his pocket and putting a few bucks on the table.
Hefty.
Or millions and millions on pretty much anything and everything, allegedly. Now, compare that to Eldrick. Eldrick said, yeah, whatever makes him uncomfortable. We already know that Eldrick hates everything about putting a dollar or two on the table. I'll tell you what makes him uncomfortable. You know what makes Eldrick uncomfortable? 20%. Or a table full of hungry Navy SEALs that have taught him all sorts of things and let them use their munitions. What I'm trying to say is nothing sounds less cool than a couple of old dudes trying way too hard to sound cool. You know what would be even better, more awesome than a duel, than bypassing all this ancillary stuff? What would be really cool is seeing these guys compete in one of the biggest tournaments of the year. To see them in the hunt on a Sunday and not off playing some one-on-one match play, grudge match, that sounds like some kind of ego stroke that you look for when you know you have no shot this week. We thought we'd see that at Augusta when these two dudes were setting course records on Tuesday, only to no-show on the weekend. And now we've got both these guys talking again. But there's no guarantee that either one of them is going to make it to the weekend, much less both of them. I mean, are you going to bet on Philip? I'm not. He's missed the cut four of the last five times he's pegged it up there. And this course has not been all that kind to the cat either. Yes, he's won the Players twice, but this course doesn't fit his eye or his game, especially if he left the flat stick busted in half in the parking lot after last weekend at Quail Hollow. So, Tiger honks. Phil fanatics, stop breathing into the paper bags and stop making this into something it's not. This is not some heavyweight battle. Well, half the card might be. Which means the cat is fighting way out of his weight class. Literally. What this is a couple of dudes on the wrong side of 40 playing the greatest hits, putting a hook into your cheek because they're now the only two old guys left standing. You know, they're like that band that's playing their hits in the desert, and they're 65. Because if you're looking for a wager this weekend, I've got one for you. It's the third dude in the group, the one rocking a flat brim and Pumas. The dude who won the tournament in 2015. The dude who nearly got himself a green jacket last month. Bet on Ricky. He's got the best chance to win that Players. The other guys, suckering y'all in. Suckering you all in.
We'll play for whatever makes him uncomfortable.
20%, cat.
Good night now!